Well, a very, very warm welcome to all of you who are present today in this lovely room, and to those of you who are part of this dialogue through simultaneous or other broadcasts. My name is Allison Bowden, and I serve here at Princeton as Dean of Religious Life and of the Chapel, the office that is hosting this visit. We are honored beyond all describing to be in the presence of His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and to share in a conversation with him on the informal motto of the university, Princeton in the nation's service and in the service of all nations. This phrase, originally coined by Woodrow Wilson, is to be formative for all who study or work at Princeton and for thousands of alumni. Indeed, an ethic of service is central to innumerable people around the globe. Today, we will all receive teachings on this ethic from someone who has taken particular bodhisattva vows and who is deeply committed to universal human values. How does the particular Buddhist understanding of saving all beings translate into ideas of service, of compassionate action to all nations? What can a Buddhist perspective contribute to everyone's understanding of the role of pride, ego, prestige, or even anger in the helping of other people? Can spiritual development be an outcome of service to others? And how does service relate to developing the heart, to growing one's compassion, the subject of His Holiness's teaching this morning? Our 150 student participants today identify with a wide range of religious communities or with none. They are from just as wide a variety of backgrounds regarding life experience and compassionate action with communities. They have been for weeks already in formal discussion groups with one another, reflecting on such questions as, what counts as service, as compassionate action? Why engage in it? How does it change the servant? And what does one learn about others in the process? Our students will continue to engage in these conversations long after His Holiness's visit to Princeton has concluded. After we hear from our esteemed guest about the meaning of compassionate action, three distinguished members of the Princeton faculty will each offer a brief response, concluding with a question for His Holiness. After he has engaged each question, we will open the floor to questions and reflections from our student audience. At that time, we ask you present to raise your hand if you have a question, and a microphone will be brought to you by Matt Weiner, Associate Dean of Religious Life, or Dave Brown, Director of the Student Volunteers Council. Our faculty panelists are Jill Dolan in the Departments of English and Theater and in the Program on Gender and Sexuality Studies, Mitch Denier in the Department of Sociology, and Eddie Glaude in the Department of Religion and the Center for African American Studies. Without further delay, let me invite now the teaching on compassionate action by His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama.
I think, firstly, I think a beginningless, rather, I think human civilization. I think key factor to survive. I think the sort of sense of, let's say, concern, well-being of the remaining community member. And also, we are social animal. I think, unlike trees, perhaps the temperature and climate, you see, may help in a certain area, certain group of tree grow. But then we have the emotion which you bring together as a social animal. Even animal, I think they always angry each other and they cannot survive. So love each other. There's not much sort of ability to, firstly, I think, know language, no? But limitations of their voice also, you see, creates some kind of sense of sort of community. No? So all, I think, the Buddhists call sentient beings who have the experience of pleasure and suffering and also cognitive power. So they are the physical attitude also, you see, some extent bring together, but mainly from mind, affection, or friendship. So therefore, I think beginningless of human civilization, human gosuya.
Since the beginning of human evolution.
I think sense of community and helping each other is the key factor for survival. And then gradually, religions, certain sort of religion, you see, means here, you see, when we face some problem, difficulties, in order to keep hope, so then concept of some superior
force.
So when we passing through desperate situation, the ordinary way, just there. Was a lost hope, but if you believe some superior force, then still if you believe that, so religious belief eventually is developed. I think original religious belief, no philosophical background, but I think often this is some dark cave, or then we say, oh, there is something. If that, please help us. If that, do not displeased, it will harm.
If that force gets displeased, it will harm me.
So then gradually, philosophy develop. Now this is from the Buddhist viewpoint. Since Buddhism, this is no concept of creator. So then you see faith with certain sort of philosophical views. Then you see develop. Then it's the concept of God, creator. And also the other tradition, the non-theistic religion, mainly three. All three belongs to Indian. Ancient Indian tradition, including Buddhism, Jainism, they developed the philosophical view, the law of causality. If you do good for other, you get benefit. If you do harm other, you get negative consequences. So that's the law of causality. No concept of creator. So all the real sort of their purpose, aim, is to further strengthening human love, human affection, human compassion. So all religion, when they describe their God, infinite love. I do no tradition say, our creator God, full of anger. Nobody say that. So therefore, the love, affection.
Okay.
in order to help other, in order to serve other, the real mover is love, sense of concern, and wish, well-being. Without that, as a duty, compulsory, without sort of volunteer feeling, then sometimes I don't know.
So it also depends upon your attitude. For example, even if you are engaging in a health beneficial service, if you...
Suppose you see some help, but out of sort of sense of concern, then the way helping more gentle way.
Gentle way.
As a duty.
Then it becomes more of a burden. So imagine if there is a puppy that needs to be saved. Two ways you can do this. One is to just, you know, grab it. And then, of course, you're saving it. The other one is to do it more gently, you know, be nice to the puppy. So although
puppy.
The act of saving
see,
is the same.
Although you see, they're supposed to protect from danger, but very rough. Then, because the puppy shouting, oh, like that. That there is no way to explain. Now I'm helping you. There's no way to explain that way. So even animal, there's no language. But the way they protect with sincere feeling, then that is real service. No sincere feeling, just done something. It's not a duty. Not much.
Feeling now.
We cannot call service. So genuine service out of sense of concern of their well-being. Then, in modern time, although I think individual independence, you see, because of the education and some other sort of factors, you see, become still among the humanity, rich and poor there, and also some successful, some difficult. So those people comparatively more unfortunate are not successful. Then it is human, because of the, I think even animal, when they hurt, you see, moving, the stronger one usually is go ahead. At the same time, they look those weaker one. If you weaker one, they are third one there.
So they watch out. The stronger ones move in the front, but constantly keep looking back to watch out the weaker ones.
So even animal, the wounded animal, the other at least licking. So you see, they also, you see, have the, because of the sense of concern of this weaker one, because social animal. Then we, social animal, then those weaker one, a little bit unfortunate, is in need of service, or help.
Special attention.
Or help. You consider something higher position and look down and helping. That's not the real sort of service. Service means respect them. And with respect, you see, serving them. That's real service. So all these things are very much connected with mental attitude. As I feel. And then, the Azala loves one change of symbolic service. Oh, the dear,
So Din mentioned the Bodhisattva vow and the ethics that go with the Bodhisattva vow. And in that Bodhisattva ethics, one speaks of three levels of ethics: ethics of restraint from harming, and ethics of gathering virtuous states of mind, and then finally the altruistic ethics of helping others, in the service of others. And in some of these texts, there are very detailed, specific lists of the kind of things those who are practitioners of Bodhisattva vow must engage in. For example, if someone, one should have a special attention and concern for the needy. For example, if you're walking on the road and you see someone carrying a very heavy, heavy load, you should offer to lighten that load by carrying yourself part of it. When you see a sick, you should be able to offer your help. And so all of these very specific. And for example, if someone seems to be confused, lost somewhere, then you should point out and help guide that individual. So those are very specific actual actions that are listed.
The 11. There are some I can't remember. So without remember, no question implementation. Like that. Now I think start question or discussion.
A dialogue, yeah.
Start questions? Okay. I'm going to start off our conversation this afternoon, and I want to start by thanking Your Holiness for your remarks. I'm very moved to join this conversation in response to your thinking, and I'm very honored to be on this panel with my esteemed Princeton colleagues. I have to say, I'm delighted to be here at a moment when we're thinking about love, when we're thinking about developing our hearts as well as our intellect. It seems to me often those of us who are here at Princeton every day concentrate quite a lot on the intellect, and it's very important that we also think about what it means to develop our hearts. I think we have a call to action in a way to think about what we do with these teachings. And I'm struck in hearing Your Holiness speak and in reading your work by your emphasis on caring for others, as you were saying, and especially for those who are suffering. I think our conversation today is about the ways in which your teaching resonates with Princeton's motto, in the nation's service and in the service of all nations. And this is certainly a notion that I think all of us embrace wholeheartedly. But often, it seems to me, we let the rhetoric of the motto carry us instead of devising practical and specific strategies for implementing our service. Really, the question becomes, what do we do? For example, how do we serve those who are suffering with a keen awareness of how they're different from us, as well as how they're the same? How do we serve without superiority or power over others? You talked about the necessity for respect. But on a global level, I think a lot as a Western feminist about how often when we think about global crises in which we truly want to help and be supportive, white women have been accused of approaching women in other countries, for instance, from Africa to the Middle East, with a posture of imperialism, in which, with the best of intentions, we wind up imposing our own values on other cultures, in which Western ideas don't necessarily translate. Cultures are different, even in the current Ebola crisis. Different burial rites make it difficult for Western healthcare workers to persuade some West Africans, for instance, that the dead should be buried quickly to prevent the spread of disease. So how then do we serve with compassion and care and sensitivity to these cultural and national differences, even though, as Your Holiness preaches, these differences ultimately are secondary to the paramount oneness of humanity? How can we truly help without doing harm? How can we cultivate joy among one another, along with compassion and respect and care?
Okay. So, I think firstly, compassion or love. 깔자 감스메와 담시 러블럽 토레 I love my culture 러블럽 토레 근데 지당 so love 슬프잖아 I think this I think common with other mammals you see they don't care about you see they 가서다 그게 치 직념 벽에서도 괜찮은 일들을 지키는 디스쿠션 최소 즉 직격을 지고 있는 그게 지금 해봐 그러나 즉 정식을 걸려야 가 세워져야지 그러나 간수 미 세워서 주잖아요 미 먹을 때는 세워지고 그러면도 그 즉 지속을 나당할 때는 세워지고 해봐
So when we talk about compassion, human compassion, in a sense we are talking about a quality that we can also see an elementary form of this among animals as well. So, for example, when dogs interact with each other, the dog will experience kind of an affinity, and the dog, one dog is not going to determine or evaluate whether or not the other dog has more impressive color or, you know, those kind of considerations is not going to come into the picture. It's the question is whether or not the dog can interact with the other dog as just another dog. So in the same way, when we talk about human connection and love and compassion, the focus of that is really the person, not really the culture or whatever that background that the person may represent, but the immediate object of those kind of basic emotions is really the individual, the person.
As I mentioned there also, the fundamental level, we are same human being. The secondary level, yes, differences. So our love, affection, really on the level of humanity or human level. I think destructive emotion, much sense of competition, or jealousy, these, I think, secondary level. Basic human level, pejit tada sas de, nanzo de mitzi kui, slavin, pejit tada nyomun samgi, dansu pejit nyomun samgi. Nanzo secondary level kan, difference mungu yu gwaro. Ti kembe, ina tada da dansu da, mungu jiyon de hachi.
So one could argue that the primary emotion that we experience at the basic human level is really that of love, connection, and compassion. Then when we move on to the secondary level of differences, and that's where the much more complex emotions like, you know, jealousy, competitiveness, and those kind of things arise. So just do a thought experiment, you know, if you know, we imagine, try to imagine that with a sort of try to develop this understanding, recognition that all human beings, just like me, wishes to be happy.
It's okay.
So that we can, that makes sense. Now try to imagine, you know, try to sort of develop hatred or anger towards the all human beings. That's almost impossible.
Can you?
His Holiness is asking question. Can you develop hatred towards the entire humanity?
Huh? Why? I think anger, hatred, could be particularly controlled.
Because for emotions like anger and hatred to arise, we need some kind of particularity of the object, some kind of solidity of the object.
Compassion, we are same. So I want happiness. do not know suffering. So because of that, the same fellow human being, someone passing through difficult, then develop a sense of concern. I think further goes, I think basic human nature, as I mentioned this morning also, the basic nature is more compassionate because our life starts that way. Our biological factor also is a more compassionate feeling. Go very well with this body. Constant anger, very harmful for our body. So I think because of that, the Rengxin Tengji Zawa Sadi, Kokada million Jawasta Shukchesta, Gogo Yetavichi. Lungla Sadi, Yong Yong Gordi, in a bit of Tengji, so survival shell, Pachi Kandayina. Circumstances, and defensive
so one could say that from even from an evolutionary point of view, the sense of connection, the ability to connect with others, ability to feel empathy for others, that seems to be a very primary level of human reality, human experience. And then, say, strong emotions like anger or hatred, they are, of course, part of our nature, but they are more specifically oriented towards a given situation where part of your survival strategy, you do need these kind of emotions. But that doesn't seem to be as primary as the fundamental kind of empathetic experience.
This side, I think, is very important.
So Solins was saying that when he asked the question, does it make sense to think of being hateful or having hatred towards the entire humanity? The students on this side, he asked that question and they all nodded saying, no, it doesn't make sense. So what about you?
Then, Kasada, agreement, unanimously. So then, let us to follow our life more compassionate way. That goes very well, basic our nature. If basic human nature is angry, anger, then we have to follow that way. Yes.
Your Holiness, in listening to you speak about the importance of compassion and kindness today, it is clear to me as a sociologist that your ideas have immense implications for the social sciences. We live in an era in which inequality has become the defining issue of our time, and it's an era of cultural and social dehumanization of marginalized groups. This unequal sides with all of the great scientific possibilities embodied by the age of big data, but also its potential arrogance. More so than before, many who have never been to a slum, nor who have any personal relationship with a single poor person, feel that they can speak with authority about inequality, poverty, ghettos, after having mastered a couple of high-level classes in statistics and perhaps the experimental method as well. These days, it is not uncommon for a seminar about the poor to focus exclusively on technical questions of selection bias or statistical technique. In the age of big data, compassion and empathy, not to speak of history theory, are less frequently the basis of our insights, not to speak of involvement or service. They are less and less seen as capacities that are pivotal to cultivating a systematic and rigorous mind. Yet one could go to the opposite extreme, and sometimes we do. It is also not uncommon for findings about the poor that derive from empathy to focus on a small number of poor people or to ignore all that we have learned over the past quarter century about selection bias. Princeton is a university in which it is well recognized that statistical work can inform empathy, where involvement is not something to look down upon, but conceivably the heart of effective intellectual work. Across the social sciences, in the work of many engaged scholars, we have models for the combination of rigor, empathy, and practice. In my own experience teaching a peers global seminar called The Global Ghetto that traveled abroad to Rome, Venice, and Warsaw, I have found that collaborations with the Office of Religious Life, with Dean Allison Bowden and Associate Dean Matt Weiner, have created opportunities for students to engage in service activities that relate to the material that we are covering in class. We have learned that if you are going to study poverty and exclusion in the 16th century Roman ghetto, our academic experience can be enriched immeasurably by some volunteer work with the gypsy population. Other opportunities on this campus through the Community-Based Learning Initiative reflect Princeton's commitment to merge learning with service and involvement. What do you see as the relationship between involvement, empathy, and the development of intellectual capacity?
I think basically, I think every human action is entirely dependent on motivation. So firstly, we should look motivation level, mental level. Then that compassionate mind, when we translate into action, then we must know the reality. So here, human wisdom or human intelligence, a very important role. Motivation, sincere motivation alone, something like kasurupana, disurupana, lapa mebe, misa vistombe sushi, so that misa vistombe sushi, so that taya lapa shushmo yene,
so you really need a combination of a sincere motivation, a compassionate motivation on the one hand, and also some insight into the understanding of the dynamics that produce the situation on the other. So the combination of them is like, if you have very good intention and motivation, but you do not have the insights that goes with it, then it's like someone who has a clear vision but has no hands to bring put anything into practice. But on the other hand, if someone is lacking the concern, the compassionate concern, then it's like having a very effective hand without the clear sight.
So here, and then also you see human sort of kasoda in human level, these difficulties are very, very complex.
They're very, always complex. Mm. Complex factors involved, yeah.
And then also, you see, we, as a human being, you see, we must tackle the root causes of these
inequality,
rich and poor. So unless you see, we study the reality of cause, conditions, and circumstances, so our action, no matter how sincere motivation, our action become unrealistic. So any unrealistic sort of effort fail to bring the result. So therefore, now I think various methods, and sincere motivation, compassionate motivation, when you translate into action, then you have to study the situation, then accordingly implement.
Thank you. Your Holiness, it's an honor to have the opportunity to dialogue with you. So I have something written down, but I have a question. There's a contradiction at the heart of what frames this conversation. Woodrow Wilson's gift to Princeton, the motto, comes alongside the fact that Woodrow Wilson segregated the White House, was one of the most racist presidents we've ever had. So the invocation of love and compassion in the face of hatred, all out of salt on the people you love, how do you muster the courage to love in the face of hate?
So when we talk about love and compassion, we also should not forget that sometimes it can take the form of a very biased perspective. So this is based on the kind of in-group and out-group. So the example that you gave of the contradiction in President Wilson is really about, you know, having this in-group, out-group perspective, which excludes a group of people from that. And that's not a genuine, you know, compassion. So what is needed is really a deep recognition that at the level of basic humanness, you know, everyone is exactly the same. Nobody wishes to suffer pain. Everybody wishes to be happy. And if you are able to arrive at that level, then there is no basis for that kind of discrimination.
And also, although I think you also mentioned, you see, the sense of concern or compassion or love, two levels, one biological factor that even animals have. But that sense of concern is very much oriented about others' attitude. So that kind of concern or love only your friends,
family love.
Your family. Even family, one member of family has a very negative attitude towards you, you can't develop. It's that kind of sort of affection. So now, there's a common with animals. Now we, as a human being, as I mentioned earlier, are sort of the biological factor sort of love or affection, with help of human intelligence, they analyze pros and cons, love, hatred. Then, with the help of human intelligence, then you develop firm conviction or loving kindness is really ultimate source of happiness. Anger, hatred is source of problem. And not only problem for other, for myself also, you see, the problem for Kasurda, ruin my health, my sleep, like that. So then, with help of intelligence, then that love, compassion, now unbiased, now not oriented about attitude. For example, love to oneself, not based on one's own attitude. We never say, I love myself because I myself very kind to me. No sense. So therefore, just by nature, you see, you want happy. You do not want suffering. So on that level, I take as a sense of concern myself. So similarly, others, including animal, including enemy, also is the one happy, do not want suffering. So on that level, develop sense of concern. That's only human being can do. So that kind of loving kindness, not oriented about others' attitude, but people themselves. So irrespective, their sort of attitude towards you. So therefore, that kind of compassion is it can reach your enemy. Biological factor, compassion cannot reach your enemy.
Just to follow up.
Yes.
So this resonates with me coming out of my study of the Black freedom struggle in the United States, and particularly Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And Dr. King offered an alternative definition of greatness. Quoted Matthew 23:11. The greatest among you is your servant. So service, being great wasn't tied to material possession, isn't tied to status or title. It's tied to serving the least of these, the most vulnerable. In some ways, that understanding reflects the view that you've been positing. And it begins or is predicated upon the recognition of this fundamental humanity of us all. I know you've been saying this, Your Holiness, but I have to get clear on it. What's blocking us from seeing the fundamental humanity of each other?
I think firstly, see, everybody, even animal, who have the feeling of self, I, so naturally, taking care of oneself, the most. So that's selfish. But without selfish, without sort of concern about self, then we will not survive. So that's very important. Now in human sort of level, in order to survive yourself, and survive happily, you need other community. Now, particularly today's world, the global economy, heavily interdependent. So therefore, you see, taking sense of concern of people of other continent, make good friend, the less competition. Competition also, you see, positive competition, negative sense of competition. So sense of, because of the positive competition, okay, both sides. So want to further develop, not remain behind. That's good. But negative competition, in order to American dollar, you see, becoming more stronger, so deliberately try to reduce the euros because of value. That's a negative competition. So both is to grow together. So good relations with Europe, European continent, European Union. Eventually, good relation with Russian Federation and Europe, and also people from China. That's everybody's interest. That's now we human beings have the ability to analyze the reality. Then it's a long-term benefit. Then through that way, we develop, you see, infinite way. No boundary or no kasa.
Without boundaries,
love. Or universal love can develop. That is the self-centered, usually I call foolish selfish. Selfish, there, useful, but wise selfish rather than foolish selfish. That is foolish and wise selfish, intelligent.
So how do So how do we determine a foolish way of pursuing self-interest versus a wise way of pursuing self-interest? It's really determined by whether or not we're able to use our intelligence and to be able to evaluate between the long-term and short-term consequences.
And then short-sighted and narrow-minded, lack of holistic view. So now modern education really immense help. You see, to open up.
Your Holiness.
So the motto is beautiful. So the modern education has the potential to open our eyes. So to make the motto real.
Oh, very good.
Your Holiness, if we could take questions now from our students. And when you ask a question, please stand, and please do not ask a follow-up question. Dave Brown and I will rotate between the two of us, so let's see some hands.
Hello, my name is Vidushi. Thank you so much for coming. I have a question about career choice and service. Particularly, I'm curious, as kids our age, we often face the choice between choosing a career that will pay us a lot of money and allow us to use that money to serve a village or a place in a large way, or perhaps to choose a career that might be more meaningful to us and might make us happier, but give us less payment, and thus maybe we would make less of an impact on the world. So I'm curious about how you would advise us facing this choice.
Of course, these things, you see, depend on case to case. That if you are 100% sure, you see, you can make more money, then I think world need money. Firstly, the huge gap, rich and poor. Mm-hmm. We cannot ignore these poor people in Africa, Asia, even in America also, you see, many poor people. So, you see, someone, you see, have to sort of take a serious concern about this. Without money, able to just good heart and smile, not help. See, to reduce this gap. So we need money. So sincerely motivated that way and make more money. I think better. Now we are very much concerned about this gap, rich and poor. Now 7 billion human beings. I think a large sort of high percentage are poor people, poverty. But if not very sure making money, then better to get firstly you said the social.
So if you're not very sure that the particular career pursuit that is not going to really lead to that kind of resources accumulation, then initially it might be better to take care of your own needs. Because in order to help others effectively, first you need to take care of yourself.
First take care of yourself, then well settle, then step by step can do more, helping others.
Because if you haven't been able to stand firm on your 2 feet, it's difficult to help others effectively.
Yes, next question.
Your Holiness, we've been talking a lot about compassion and emotion and things on a very personal level. So I was wondering if you feel that the arts and artistic expression have a role to play in service, and if these can be considered acts of service in and of themselves.
Art. I think the promotion of human value, promotion of peace, promotion of understanding, the huge gap, rich and poor, right? Promotion, understand. The artistic way, very powerful sort of medium. So to some people, through artistic way, you can carry more sort of clear sort of message. So as I mentioned earlier, every human activities can be positive, so long motivation, aim is good, then okay, very good. Next question.
Thank you, Your Holiness, for being here. Your presence makes me happy. I just wonder, I suppose my question is, I wonder how you respond to people or how you get through to people who seem to have no interest in service or in governing their lives by compassion. How do you get through to someone who is kind of immersed in a world of antagonism and competition and drive or something like that?
Yes. Now this is real problem. That's why you see, I often you see expressing the very existing of modern education system is very much oriented about the material value. And so you see, not much talk about this inner value. So this inner value, promotion of this inner value, not by force, not by law, but by voluntarily. In order to carry voluntarily or interest or seriousness about these things, you have to know the pros and cons. self-centered attitude, what benefit? More compassionate attitude, what's wrong? What's wrong? Right. Oh, then, for example, this is some doctor advised you, and as a result, now you know how to take care of your own body, your health. So then, voluntarily, you see, taking care. Similarly, mental level, harmful emotion, or constructive emotion, once we know, identify these things, and pros and cons, then voluntarily, you see, you yourself make familiar this positive emotion, and try to a little bit distance from this destructive emotion. That's the way change our mind. So education, awareness. So the education itself, not much pay attention about these things. Then the society, more materialistic sort of culture, materialistic life. When we are very young, we very much appreciate mother's affection, or parents' affection, or friends' affection. And they themselves also, you see, share more affectionate attitude towards your sort of immediate friends. Then gradually grown up, and then the day-to-day life, you acting like more aggressive, then for temporary, sometimes more successful. That also newspaper, for those people who
So unfortunately, also in the media, quite often people who tend to have no morals tend to get more coverage and seem successful.
I think I often use it telling media people, some killing, murder, sexual abuse, scandal, become news. Taking care, millions of young children, millions of old people, sick people, is not news. So gradually, you see, people who always say, look, newspaper, like that, then gradually develop sort of concept, oh, basic human nature is negative, bad. And self-centered hard work is the only way to get more successful. Clear? So the whole sort of, I think, the society way.
Contemporary culture.
Oh. But society,
so each part of the society, each one of us really has a responsibility to correct this.
So media people also have immense responsibility. Is to educate people. Negative things report, should report. Meantime, the positive things also is must report. Then people can judge. And then some more sort of explanation. The positive things are long run, immense benefit. Negative thing, temporary, some satisfaction to emotion, but long run, very harmful. And then most important is education field. When we are very young, so very much alive about value of affection. Then most of you is this age now, day-to-day life, affection not much sort of relevant. Then education mainly, you see, talking about wealth, the material value. And a good name, good face, a good dress. I think too much advertising. Because I mean, number of advertising.
So, for example, you see a huge amount of energy spent on advertising, clothes and beauty products and so on.
Oh. No one telling. Because I think deeper value. Christmas,
The only thing that closest you can see is the drawing, the image of heart around the Christmas time.
That's not sufficient. Don't worry. Yes, next question.
My name is Carolyn, and I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, where I live about 10 miles from Ferguson. Many students from St. Louis here at Princeton feel as if we cannot make true social change at home because of the privilege we have been granted from attending an elite university such as Princeton. So a question for both Your Holiness and perhaps Professor Gold. How can Princeton students vested in Ferguson reconcile service, social justice, and privilege?
I think that question, I think, more relevant. I don't know.
Wow.
Yes, basically, as I mentioned earlier, say we repeat 1,000 times equality, equality. But in reality,
of course, we may repeat the idea of equality 1,000 times, but on reality, often many other considerations take over, like economy and other power and so on.
So these are long-run goal through education, through awareness, and through effort. I think we should. I often used to telling these, I think, genuine happy humanity and so without the presence of this discrimination, these things will not take overnight. Mm. We have to make effort, mainly through education and media and I think various fields. I think that these are our common responsibility. So same goal, same aim, and then different profession, use different profession and aiming that, including the factory who making toys, a small gun,
a video game,
killing, better, less, like that. So it's a various sort of profession or field. Is aiming how to promote peaceful society, harmonious society. So if we start effort with clear
goal,
perhaps after 20 years, 30, 40 years, new generation who come through that kind of education, eventually in that kind of society, then I think a better world can materialize. These are not easy. The materialistic life also not develop overnight. More material things and carbon, more technology, and then gradually you see this kind of. I think at least maybe a few generations is in this now new modern society, modern
lifestyle
is develop. So now change that. One or two individual people cannot do. Mass movement, right? That also through education. Our government also cannot do much. Even the United Nations cannot do much. So these ultimately individuals' responsibility. So in order to carry individual risk because of the effort, education is a key factor. Next question.
Thank you for being here, Your Holiness. My name is Amantia. I am from Albania, and I love
Oh, Albania.
I left my country when I was 16 on a scholarship to study. Since the day I left, I, just like I think every single international student here, have been asked if I will go back to my country. You talk about the oneness of humanity, but you also are concerned and speak for the Tibetan people, who are your people. So my question is, do we have a specific responsibility to serve the people of our kin? In other words, do I have to go back to my country?
This depends on Kangipayu. Okay. I think the Albania, I think comparatively, still difficult country, economically, or
the political situation.
So, young, the young person, is who have good opportunity. Study and also experience the United States,
a free world.
And really, I think worthwhile. I think, Lithuania or some other country, former communist country, but some leaders, as far as I remember, is educated in America, return and serve their own country. So you also, I think, Kasoda.
So you need to really look at the larger picture of society and your role, but at the same time, you also need to think about more specific needs of what you can do.
So your own area, properly sort of develop, as we already discussed, the external conditions or facilities, this economy, and meantime, internal values. Your own country, if you have, I think generally speaking, you may have, a good opportunity. Use that opportunity, make effort, then that also contribution for serving humanity also. If Serbian people, because the Albanian people not belong to humanity, then okay, forget. But not that case, humanity. My own case, of course, I'm a Tibetan. As much I can sort of serve Tibetan. We also is a part of the humanity. And then our case, we have, I think, as far as sort of knowledge about inner value and psychology, knowledge of psychology, these things, I think Tibetan tradition actually come from Nalanda. So highly advanced sort of knowledge about Kasajuti, psychology on these things. So preservation of these things are not only interest for Tibetan people, but also, I think, to some extent, I think humanity, I think worthwhile to preserve like that. I think when you take care, for example, when you take care of your teeth, so they're going to catch over.
So, for example, when you are taking care of your teeth, you have to pay attention to individual tooth. So, for example, you cannot say that you're taking care of your teeth while you completely ignore one or two tooth that are falling off.
Next question.
Hello, His Holiness. Thank you for making time for us today. I'm Kathleen Ryan, and I'm from Virginia, but now I live in New York City. And every day, I probably see between 5 and 20 people in extreme suffering. Homeless people who have mental problems, health problems, pregnant women, many, many things. And I wonder, how do I continually live out the compassion that we've been talking about with regard to all those people while still getting from one place to another and being compassionate toward the people I said I would, you know, meet at 3:15 or be home by 9 p.m. How do I do that every day?
As I mentioned earlier, if we have holistic view, look wider perspective, then the plenty of factors which give us enthusiasm or hope. If you just look one aspect, these negative things, only that anger,
only suffering,
only suffering is unrealistic sort of attitude. There are many good things and good potential. So now here again did one. Shandag Dung Shu something sim shu chayak again chick to one. Dako Shandag Dung Tong to Dung Tong the Sim Shu Kong to Beto didn't know.
So of course as a human being when you're confronted with on a day to day basis acute sufferings that is going to affect you, distress is going to be part of your response. But what is required is also some method that would continue to retain your courage and being sort of a sense of being empowered so that at least you can help. That needs to go together.
Okay. Next question.
So, Your Holiness, in an earlier response, you stressed the fundamental nature of human compassion to true service. So I was wondering about how that changes when you're applying service to a really large scale. Is it possible to keep this human connection when we're dealing not with individuals interacting with individuals, but with companies and large NGOs interacting with governments and nations?
So earlier we did speak about the fact that it is possible to develop a sense of compassion for a group, for a larger community.
Or entire humanity. And even, I think, furthermore, entire sentient being. Billions, billions of galaxies, sentient being on different galaxies. We can develop. Rang do la pelo la slani. Ta dawan dawa to tumhe mein to chisu cha samna to.
So you know there is a line in one of the Buddhist texts which says take your own body as an example and restrain from harming others. You know, restrain from inflicting pain on others' body. So this is a principle that we can extend even to all sentient beings, not just human beings, because each sentient being instinctively wishes to avoid suffering and wishes to attain happiness.
So according to theistic religion, the entire creature of God preserve respect and taking care. Actually, we have no direct contact with God, with Creator. But we have direct contact with creations, right?
Creatures
of God. So only opportunity is serving creatures. That indirectly best way serve God. Okay.
So the point is that human mind is quite flexible. So if you cultivate the attitude, you can maintain that intention even when you're working at the level of groups, not just individuals. So none of us were born as a professor. So someone becomes a professor after many years of study and research and experience of teaching and so on.
So similar to this mental attitude, through training, through familiarization, we can change. Next question.
Hello, His Holiness. Thank you for coming here today. It's been fantastic. My name is Jordan. I'm from Newark, New Jersey. So growing up in the inner city, I've seen so much poverty. I've seen so much homelessness, so much crime. And I've tried to do so much in the past in high school to try to help so many people, but I felt so limited in what I could do because there is so much danger in Newark. You can't just go helping people. You can't go helping with Habitat for Humanity build houses because there's just some neighborhoods that you wouldn't want to walk through. And so my question for you is, how do you maintain that compassion and that hope for the future, hope to actually continue to sustain that service when you just feel so limited and when you feel like there's people who don't want the help that you're trying to give, or you feel like there's people who you can't reach with your help because it's a danger to your own health? How do you maintain that hope when it seems like there's no hope to be given to a certain group of people?
So this is very true. Of course, there are while you are engaged in service, there are going to be a lot of complications, and in some situations, your limitations will be very obvious. But at the same time, what is important in those situations is also to be cognizant of your own ability to make changes in other areas so that you do not feel overwhelmed and discouraged by an experience of this adverse situation.
Next.
Catholic and been raised Roman Catholic my entire life. And when we were having our smaller discussion, we were talking about the concept of service itself and what actually constitutes service. Because a lot of times for most people, an individual who goes to another country to, say, build houses is considered to be doing service. But say your roommate has a bad day and you give them a hug, or you just see a stranger and you smile at them. Like, for me, that is service. But where do you draw the line between service and humanity or just compassion? And should there really even be a line?
So you're right, and probably the traditional attitude to what constitutes service, which is kind of, traditionally can imagined as someone going to the third world country doing something materially visible, that probably is conditioned by society's way of taking material needs as being very primary. But on the other hand, if we understand that suffering takes many forms, including mental suffering as well, and if we have that kind of more expanded notion of what suffering and needs are, then helping someone who is in distress, giving a counsel or comforting, kind of, you know, a hug, these will be seen as service as well, because their aim is to elevate the pain and suffering of that individual. Many of us, when we think about suffering, we tend to think really in very physical terms.
Both, you know, suffering and joy.
Suffering and happiness. We tend to think in very sensory and physical terms. But in fact, if you think carefully, the mental level experience of pain and happiness is more, you know, important.
Obviously, we all have experienced mental level, calm, happy. Then physical pain can subdue. The mental level, too much fear, too much worry. Then physical comfort will not subdue that. So obviously, mental level experience are much more serious than the physical level. So material value mainly is to provide comfort in physical level. Nice things to see, including sports, these provide some sort of comfortable eyesight, right?
Sensory.
Then music, ear, smell, nose. Sometimes my nose is in this side, not very good. So, enjoy just him that.
Then you can't enjoy fully the smell.
Then taste, then touch. Touch including sex. So these are mainly also the sensorial experiences. So we have to sort of pay more attention about mental level experiences. So far, among the psychologists or consulta brain specialist,
So even if you look at the kind of modern Western disciplines that deal with human experience, you know, there doesn't seem to be a clear recognition of the difference between mental level experience versus sensory level experience.
Since some time back, I think at least 10, 15 years, I'm requesting the scientist, you know, through level Shinju Cheni, the level of Shari, Gwangen Shiva, then Jay Shiva, Yilunga to Jibin Negota, Gwangen Shiva, Matiba, Yilunga to Jibin Nego, Brin, then the Nungu Meda Yarsanki.
So His Holiness has made requests to some of the neuroscientists, the brain specialists, that they should try to do some experiment and observe the difference between a person whose mental activity is occurring while the sensory modalities are, you know, active, versus someone whose sensory modalities are not active but mental image is there. So, you know, from our own personal experience, we can make that distinction, but there must be a different brain expressions between these two different states.
Because Alabama University.
So there was a symposium on brain plasticity and healing at the University of Alabama, and the moderator, one of the scientists, made the point that, you know, in the traditional view of science, the causal relation between brain and mind was a one way. It was the changes in the brain occurs, then that affects the mind. But now there is a growing recognition that causal direction can go the other way as well. Changes in the mind and thoughts can affect changes at the level of brain. And this is something that His Holiness was saying that he had heard from other scientists as well. So there is a growing recognition of the mind-brain relationship going both ways.
So through training of mind, and it affects our brain.
And people have done research that shows that through conscious training of the mind, brain changes occur, and in fact, birth of new neurons as well, which is explained on the basis of brain plasticity.
I think these findings, very, very helpful. Eventually, we develop certain kind of attitude. It's dealing with mind, dealing with sensorial experiences. Namju level also shivai homar se level yena to level jang jang samtang mudwa.
Because otherwise, if our view of the human mind is confined just to brain processes, then we will only think of brain.
Then ultimate, what's the refuge, is instrument, surgery. If beside the brain, there is some other element which can affect our brain, then training our mind is something relevant. I think the education itself,
in fact, if you think deeply, the whole ethos behind education, the whole philosophy behind education is not about sensory gratification. It's really about cultivating the mind. So, for example, sensory modalities are definitely a medium through which we receive information about the world. But when we think about memory and consolidation of knowledge, it's really at the mind level.
Isn't it? Do you have some objection? Or argument? Disagreement? No. Yes.
Hello, His Holiness. I'm a little nervous, but thank you so much for your presence. My question is about rage, and it's in light of Professor Ba's question and what's going on in Ferguson. And I guess my question is, for this talk and your earlier talk, you mostly talked about compassion and love, but I want to ask, can you be in rage, or can you be in rage towards something or someone and also be compassionate at the same time? Like the common saying is, even in the face of oppression, love your oppressor, show love. But I want to ask, what do you do when that isn't enough? For example, in terms of what's going on in Ferguson, I personally believe that if Darren Wilson is not indicted, I don't think I can love him. I don't think I could do that. And in your earlier talk, you talked about separating the actor from the action. And in cases like this, as a black person in the United States, I can't separate Darren Wilson. I guess I don't know what he did from himself, because he did commit a crime. So I'm just wondering, how do you go about delineating those two things? Thank you.
Yes. I think basically, according ancient Indian psychology, it seems You see, most destructive emotion is spontaneous.
Instant.
The positive emotions are so destructive emotion training chas ki mundwa. The positive emotion the training chan yuan dwa.
So
chasanga positive emotion training chan chimba ji tamba yore. Instantly yong da di ko lu bu jeng ge chong ma da di ha ma cha de yin du zan ni xi ze training chan ni positive emotion di shuk chimba yeba yin na ada lu bu li ya da ji jeng chi lang ba de chong bu yin ni shrame de ge chi cha ba yore.
So one distinction that you find from ancient Indian psychology is kind of a categorical distinctions between those emotions that tend to be destructive versus those that tend to be constructive. And destructive emotions on the whole are understood to be more instinctual. They are reactive and they arise in response to a particular situation or a threat and so on. Whereas the constructive emotions tend to be ones that are more cultivated, that are more kind of firm. So, and therefore, if you can emphasize the constructive emotional part, then as they become more strengthened, then they can also, you know, even though strong negative emotion, you know, arises in response to an unjust situation, they may not fester, they may not last very long.
It seems to me like body's sort of the basis of body's health, immune system. If your immune system is strong, then some virus enter your body. If immune system is strong, may not disturb much. If immune system weak, then slight sort of virus can disturb more. Similarly, mental sort of the attitude, certain sort of positive emotion, through training and become familiar, like immune system, strong. Then immediate sort of kasoda, what's a destructive emotion, come, may not disturb much and may not remain long. So in order to these sort of kasoda, gaining these sort of knowledge, we need more study about the world of emotion or map of emotion. That's very important. So once we have fuller knowledge about the whole map of the emotion, then you get a clearer picture about mental levels or asoda,
processes.
Like that. So then, next question. Oh?
My name's Damaris. And this morning in your talk, you said that we should share others' problems as a way of building community that's so essential. And I want to ask you about two obstacles I see in that practice. The first is that as a college student, I live in a place that's very distracting and in many ways encourages me to be self-absorbed. And so there are many days in which I might walk by the man who's struggling with the box and I don't even look up because I feel like I'm too busy, or if I do look up and I think I don't have any time to help him, so I just keep walking. The other obstacle I see is that sometimes when you share others' problems, the weight of those problems become your problem. And so my question is, how do we overcome these obstacles, either the obstacle of being too distracted to notice those around you who need help, or the obstacle of sharing others' problems but letting the weight of those problems become unbearable?
Yes. sino chua di yung ku yore. Ta tila ya, ti ning ji sambe to sambe chi yon dewa di voluntary tan yung warwa. Ting di ning du yuwa si yon dewa re. Sa di di kiawa chik duwa. Ta tila yun, chalab se che yun kare.
With respect to your second question, in fact, His Holiness was citing. So, in fact, it reminded His Holiness of a question that was raised in an 8th century Indian Buddhist text, where the question was raised, why should I care for others' pain? Because it brings me more pain. Why should I take on more additional pain when I have my own? And the response given is that the experience of distress that comes with sharing someone else's pain is real. But the difference between experiencing one's own suffering without any control versus the distress that comes in the process of sharing someone else's suffering is this. In the case of sharing someone else's suffering, there's an element of voluntariness on your part. You chose to share in that experience, which really suggests a kind of a courage on your part. Whereas when you undergo your own experience, there isn't that voluntary dimension. So it's a qualitatively different experience. So that was a response given, something that you could find benefit from. And the first question, His Holiness was saying that, even in among the Tibetans, although compassion is promoted culturally, but sometimes people do come up with excuses saying, oh, so how sad, how sad, how sad. They just sort of walk by simply by saying how sad. So, of course, it depends also on the environment and the cultural conditioning, because sometimes people just don't pay attention because it isn't really is part of their value system. So those things make a difference too.
Jik shampen go lo ya jik yan de tebu the pain de jik samur khon ye bina ne azi ta de jik sung go mala na ta so jik so sung gil tik so jil le to so so tan da de ta ka da jin ne go ro da.
So in fact, someone who cherishes and values altruistic kind of sentiments, helping others, and if that figures prominently in that person's value system, then even if you ignore someone who is in dire need and walk past, you would feel uncomfortable because it really sort of violates your own value.
Talk room and we could what is up. Time?
Yeah, I think we could this round up. Yeah, the last.
Thank you for coming today, Your Holiness. My question is sort of similar to the first one about what we choose to do after college. Many people here have good intentions, but may struggle to find their specific path where they can best use their talents and their abilities. And we are faced with many opportunities, everything from starting a charity to maybe doing small acts of kindness in other ways. So how would you suggest we best convert these good intentions into actions of service in an unselfish manner?
It really depends upon the depth of your conviction in the value of helping others. So if your conviction in the value of helping others is really deep, then it will, your experience will continue to reinforce it. But if it is something that has been part of a kind of a fad, then of course, as you experience other adversities, that intention is not going to last very long.
Namjiada, ngay tawag mo ng tiyab tigil, ano siyempre ngan na ano ba siya sa chulat?
So His Holiness was saying that on his own part, he on a daily basis continued to reinforce his commitment to altruistic sentiment by, you know, particularly using the four lines from Shantideva, the same text, 8th century, where there is a verse which reads, as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain and help dispel the miseries of the world.
So such sort of thinking, a daily basis, reminds. Then the conviction, year by year, increasing.
So it's in this way, you have to try to really habituate yourself to this way of thinking.
Professor Chaya Koi, the ABC did ma lemni. Did much of a system now, sungi che. Any curriculum at the bed, kumji den, in top of a child world.
So earlier I gave the example of how someone becomes a professor, but the journey began from first learning the alphabets and then not forgetting them and building knowledge on top of that. And at some point you gain expertise in your special field and domain.
Then the jumbo jet dong into the city, near the shin. And the Nipiki John Dartos, and the Nipit, Kwamje, and Larosho Totito.
So, for example, if you have seen the, you know, cockpits of those jumbo jets, you know, these people have to first learn the study how to, you know, fly them, how to pilot the plane, and then they have to practice, rehearse, and then finally it becomes effortless.
Mm-hmm. Some occasion, the cockpit has asked me to come. Cockpit, sorry.
Inside the cockpit, yeah. Uh-huh.
And look, so many switch. The huge jump out, come on, or the wrong switch.
So unless you are really well trained and habituated, you know, you might end up pulling the wrong switch.
I think 1956, Buddha Jayanti celebration. I think within India, there's some
flights. Flights, yeah.
Oh, Dodiaj. Because the Chushu's with the Nayorva Dango Dimdoria, Kurujorva. And then Haya, because the Chief, I mean, the pilot taking Haya, Jacas would forget, then took Slavachon Hassa. And Lavor Changache.
In 1956, when I visited India
Buddha Jayanti celebration
to celebrate the Buddha's 2500th anniversary of the Buddha's death, one of the travels involved a flight, and the pilot invited me to sit inside the cockpit and to actually, you know, hold on to the steering wheel. And there was, you know, incidentally, there was a little bit of turbulence as well. So my attendants, you know, my delegation, they were sitting in the main passenger area. So, you know, when we landed, they all said, well, there was a little turbulence. Maybe you were playing with the steering.
Thank you.